America behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin, the auto editor here at HowStuffWorks.com.
And I am Scott's favorite co-host, Ben Bolin, video writer and podcaster here at the self-same website.
Favorite co-host. I like that.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, that's true.
De facto, at
least. It's true. Hey, first thing, I'm a little stuffed up, so you may hear that along the way here. I apologize for that. Hopefully it'll clear up soon. Really soon, but more than usual anyways. One thing, Ben, I wanted to tell you about something. This is something I came in kind of excited about a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
And there's a reason for it. I mentioned that I had stopped by an auction house here in town, kind of a high-end auction house, and I just window peeping because they had, they have online, they list a number of vehicles for sale. And this is where I saw, at one point they had several, Good Humor ice cream trucks parked outside. They often have a lot of roadsters, just really unique antique vehicles parked
cool.
outside. And not that I can afford to, you know, go and pick up a vehicle at auction at any one of these places, but I was looking in the window one weekend, and I saw this car behind the glass, and it was right in the showroom, which I thought was kind of strange to begin with. It wasn't in the garage area in the back. And what I thought was really weird about this car was that it's kind of this combination boat car thing, but then it also had an airplane propeller attached to the front of it.
Ah, a propeller-driven vehicle?
A propeller-driven vehicle.
Now, was this on the front or the back?
It was on the front of the vehicle, and I've got a photo of this thing here for you.
No
way. I was able to find the artist's website, and you may have just noticed that I said artist because I just blew it, I guess, but I went back when this place was open.
Wow.
And I looked at, I walked in and went immediately over to the vehicle and I started looking at it and I realized there was a lot of things not quite right about it. Okay, first of all, it's on what looks like bicycle wheels.
Yeah.
They're
those
white
are
bicycle wheels
three
with real,
bicycle
real thin
wheels.
Tires. But the proportions of this vehicle almost make it look, appropriate. I mean, it seems like that might be right. This thing's big, by the way. It looks like an old silver and wood and clad boat. It has like a real, real strange look to it. It's almost like a tube with flat pontoons on the side. Lots of chrome, lots of, I guess that's nickel, maybe. But it does have headlights. It does have, you know, three wheels, rather. It's got one wheel in the back. It's a tadpole configuration. There's a prop at the front, a big airplane prop at the front, and a tiny little one at the back, which is kind of just, I don't know, decorative, it looks like.
Okay.
So this thing confused me all around, right? You can see why.
Yeah, it's a confusing
big.
Vehicle.
It's pretty big. That's the top of the windshield there is about waist high. But it does have a seat for the driver, and the throttle, I don't know if you can tell, but there's no steering wheel. It just looks like boat controls, like maybe throttle for boat controls. It has two of them side by side.
Curiouser and curiouser.
Very strange, right?
Yeah.
And then I started looking at this thing, and I realized that there's very little clearance between the prop and the ground, and it didn't look like it was really all that, it didn't look like it was big enough to propel this thing.
It's not functional.
It's a sculpture. This car is a sculpture.
No way.
So it had me fooled through the glass. And then, you know, closer still had me a little bit fooled, but not quite, because I thought something's not right. Then I asked the proprietor there, and they said, no, it's a sculpture that we're going to be auctioning off.
And just so everyone knows, you have to get up pretty early in the morning to fool Scott Benjamin. I mean that literally. The last time I fooled Scott, I had to get in the office at 4:45.
That's right. And you did fool me pretty good with that.
It was all right.
No, this vehicle, I mean, I'm looking at it even now, and I'm thinking, like, I could see this thing actually on the road, like, working. But, I mean, it's very frail looking, I guess it'd be the way to put
it. Yeah, especially at the wheels.
Yeah. And if you want to take a look at this thing. The artist's name is Philip Stapleton, and the piece is called The Parisian Roadster. It's difficult to find online, and the website is really tough to go through. It's not very well laid out. And anyways, he's done a few of these. One looks like a bumper car. Another one looks like a, I think they call it Bonneville. It looks like kind of a land speed type car, but they all have this wood and nickel design to them. Not really functioning cars, but more sculpture anyways. But, so this got me excited because when I found it and before I knew it wasn't a real car, I started looking around for prop driven cars. And, cause it does look like a car from, I mean, this looks like it's like a 70 year old car.
Yes,
like
at
a,
least.
Like a really neat-looking 70-year-old car. Yeah. Well, there's this this period of time in French history when prop-driven cars were somewhat of a thing. They were coming around, like, you know, people were saying, well, one guy was building several of these in a row, saying this may be the next thing, the next way to power our cars. So, I don't know. I was kind of thinking that maybe this was a living example of one of these, but not the case.
Now, we should go ahead and say that, well, I should say at least, because this is more my bad. When Scott first told me about this, I had no idea, my friend, that propeller-driven vehicles went back so far or were so numerous during their time.
Oh, yeah. There were several of these. And, I mean, if you look around, you could find old, you know, modern mechanics articles, popular science articles. Yeah. And I've got a few of these in front of me here. You know, some go back to the 1930s. Some go back farther than that. I know that – I think the Germans were experimenting with one early 1900s.
Yeah, we've got it looks like we both got some we're both packing some list here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a few.
Yeah, do you want to kick it off, or you want me to?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, probably the one that you'd be able to find the simplest online, the one that you would be able to see and maybe even find a YouTube video of this thing running is by no means in any order. It will be maybe later, but there's one called the, I'm going to try to pronounce this, Helicron.
Yes.
Is that right?
I think that's close enough. You came out in 1932, right?
Yeah, that's right. This is the wooden one, right? The wooden, it's wooden and blue. The metal's blue. You got a picture of it in front of you as well. This is a barn find.
That's what blew me away. Yeah.
I know it's one of these that, remember I mentioned that, you know, in France there was this guy that was building these vehicles, and I'm going to run across his name in just a moment here. Let's see. It was this example, this Helicron, the one that you'll find online all over the place.
Yeah.
This was hidden in a barn. Of course it was just parked, you know, by someone in the 1930s and just left there, really. It's one of those stories. It says that it has a two-cylinder four-stroke engine that was replaced with a four-cylinder air-cooled Citroën GS engine. And the propeller, which actually drives the vehicle, is just a great big wooden propeller in front, and it can reach speeds up to 75 miles per hour, and it's still considered legal on French roads, Paris roads, I should say.
Which is baffling for two reasons. Primarily, it's baffling that it's still street legal. Secondarily, that it's also very baffling when you just look at the propeller to think that that would drive the vehicle, because there are only two props in the propeller, and they're both sort of encircled.
Yeah, two arms on the propeller.
No,
that's right.
Yeah, two arms, but they're both encircled, and
it's huge.
It is huge.
It's huge. This thing, and it really drives. I've watched this thing online on the video. It doesn't. Oh, that's one thing about these things, you know, and I should mention this early off, is that they do have some downsides.
Oh, yeah.
And, oh, you know, one other quick thing while we're talking about this. These aren't flying cars.
No.
You know, because these may be somehow confused with, might be confused somehow with flying cars. They're not flying cars. These are cars that are driven by props on the ground.
Okay? Yeah, they're just different propulsion systems.
Just to get that out of the way. Yeah, different propulsion. But, they do have some downsides. One of those is slow acceleration, and you'll see that in this video, if you watch the Helicron video. Apparently they had poor fuel economy, although I've seen something that has contradicted that they get, you know, this is in the 50s, they were getting 30 or 40 miles per gallon.
Yeah, there's some conflicting data out there. I think what may be causing that conflict of, you know, fuel economy stats is probably the lack of documentation for a lot of these vehicles.
Oh, could be.
So
no one was really concerned with the fuel economy of these things at the time, anyways.
This was back when you could kick a rock and find an oil spout.
Yeah, that's right. Shooting at some food.
I think I know the guy that we were talking about. Oh, wait, let's do downsides.
Oh, yeah, downsides. And the other, just a couple more, terribly noisy. I mean, these things are, I mean, it's like, well, it's being like in an open
cockpit.
There you go. There you got it.
Yeah.
Open cockpit airplane. And also the danger aspect of these things, because you've got an open prop right in front of you. Some of them have a small cage built out of what looks like chicken wire around them.
Yeah.
That's not going to protect anything.
It didn't look like a propeller.
No, these are pedestrian choppers if I've ever seen them, because huge plane. I mean, we're talking about like a overall length of these things, like maybe a 7-foot prop. 8-foot prop
easily
in front of the car or behind the car, depending on the design. Dangerous. Very dangerous.
I just personally would want – this is why I asked earlier about the original art piece that spawned this podcast, because I don't like the idea of it being behind a prop, a moving prop in a car going at a high speed. Not into it.
Yeah, the same thing with like an airboat. You know those big airboats?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of a irrational fear of those that, you know, you'd fly back into the prop on those.
You get sucked in.
But it's the same thing. I mean, if you look at it, its proportion is the same on that. I mean, that's the type of propeller, the size of propeller we're talking about. You know, they didn't have radial engines, I don't think. You know, there may have been, I'm not going to say they didn't. There probably was one or two that did, because there were a lot of people experimenting with these, but, oftentimes they would use just a standard automobile engine to power the prop. And, I don't know. It just seems like overall seems like a bad idea to me.
Well, that is true, I would say, for private vehicles.
Okay.
For cars. But before we move from cars, we need to bring back, the guy that we were talking about earlier, Marcel Léat, I believe.
That's the guy, Ben. That was the guy. He built 30 vehicles. And apparently, there's only two of these things left.
Yeah, two Helicas.
Oh, two, really?
Are they Helicas, I think?
Yeah, cool.
That he has left?
That's cool. I didn't know, because he had several different designs. Helica may be just a general term for these things.
Maybe that is.
But between 1913 and 1926, he built 30 vehicles like this. So they were out there. And he wasn't the only one doing this. I mean, there were Maybach was doing it. There were other designs too. There was an Isetta that had a prop to it. There was also a Messerschmitt that had a prop. So the Germans were doing that. And there was also an Argentinian car called the Aero Car that they were actually talking about building in California in the 1950s. One of the things that they decided was just not possible was because you're going to have this car in a densely populated area like Los Angeles.
Sure.
And you've got a 6-foot prop on the back of this car that's spinning at speeds that they would be in like an airplane. Just not safe.
Especially, you know, if you are at an intersection and you're in stop and go traffic.
Yeah.
It's just not feasible because of the acceleration time.
Oh, sure. That too. Yeah. Well, what if a motorcycle rolls up behind you and doesn't stop in time?
Wow. Well, I guess.
Sliced and diced.
Things could get ugly. Yeah.
That's right.
But also we should mention the Russians were doing a lot with they had the Aerosan.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like turn of the century, 1910s, 1909, '09, I could say.
Very cool.
Can we call this '11 now? Because it's like a zero in front of it.
I guess so.
I don't want to look like a jerk. But the Russians had these things that look sort of like snowmobiles or skimobiles with a prop at the front or the rear.
Very cool.
And this is, if you think about it, you really get some bang for your buck if you have a prop-driven snow vehicle, just because you don't have to worry about, you don't have to worry as much about some of the mechanics that come into play when you're rolling tires on a surface.
Ah, that's another one of the benefits of the cars too, is that you don't have to worry about wheel spin.
Yeah.
You've got no transmission, no clutch, often no brakes on these things, unless there's secondary brakes, you know, where, airspeed, you're trying to control airspeed with the prop. Well, airspeed, I guess it'd be ground speed at this point,
yeah.
But, brakes would be completely secondary if necessary at all. And, that's another thing they said that, you know, they can traverse, snow-covered, mud-covered pathways with no problems at all. And I guess it fits in perfectly with, snowmobiles.
Yeah.
This one that I'm looking at is on four skis.
Yes.
And it's got a machine gunner in the front.
It was a rough time in Russia.
I guess so. Yeah.
They conventionally, from what I understand, they use these, toward the Far East, Siberia, Trans-Siberian area, for things like mail delivery, border patrol. So the one we're looking at is probably for border patrol.
And that's called the Aerosan? Aerosan?
Yeah.
Very cool.
And then they also would use it for medical transport.
Ah.
But it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop with cars. There's a guy named George Binney in the 1920s who built something called a railplane. I remember we were talking earlier about this thing in New Zealand where you pedal.
Oh, yeah. I'll think of the name of that in a minute.
Oh, gosh. It's a cool name.
Yeah, it is. I'll try.
we'll get back on that one. But, yeah, check this out, Scott. It's a propeller-driven monorail and originally wanted it to go between Glasgow and Edinburgh. So it had a four-blade propeller, but this is interesting because it was on each side.
Oh, neat.
And people were really going to build this track, but again, safety concerns got in the way. A lot of the propellers that you'll see on these propeller-driven vehicles are built of wood.
Ah,
and
okay.
So durability can come into play.
This looks like a truss built over top of a conventional railway.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So they had the routes already laid out.
They kind of already had infrastructure.
So they just add to the existing track. I don't know, just the infrastructure that's already there.
Right, yeah.
And they've got this rail. That's really cool.
So they're kind of tracing the line, but
it's like a monorail car hanging upside down.
Yes, it is exactly like exactly. And the thing is, oh, I almost had that New Zealand word.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Squeegee. Yeah,
we'll get it.
Weedle. I don't know. But,
Weedle.
I don't know. But the thing is, these things had, electric power and they had a cruising speed, according to the sources I found, in excess of 100 miles per hour.
Whoa.
So talk about public transit, right?
Yeah.
But it's all good until
And what year was this?
This was, I believe this was 1920s.
And
couldn't nail down the exact
year. A cruising
speed
of 100 miles per hour?
I know.
Hour.
It's essentially a high-speed train.
Wow.
Or as far as function goes for consumers.
Yeah.
But again, the safety concerns, because no insurer would help them out. All you need is one arm of one prop flying off.
Oh, yeah.
And it, especially those speeds, it could damage the track. It could wreak havoc below.
Oh, sure, because it throws everything off balance. And if this thing is hanging below the track, mm-hmm. it's going to start swinging and swaying and hit one of the supports and then mayhem and madness.
And it's going 120 miles an hour.
Exactly, yeah. That would be a bad scene, that's for sure. You know, the cars were equally fast. They That's the crazy thing about these is that they accelerate slowly because, you know, they have to get all of that mass moving. However, they did have a high top speed. In fact, one of them, I think in 1927, was able to created a new land speed record.
Yeah, it topped,
a French track.
Mm-hmm. It topped, 145, I think.
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, I think it was given in kilometers, so maybe
170
kilometers.
Yeah.
Like 170 kilometers or something like that. We'll have to look it up here in a minute.
We're checking through that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a Helica.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it reached 170 kilometers
thing.
There. Now,
very cool.
Monsieur Léat, who built these, had also went on to design planes. So a lot of his designs very much look like someone took a body of a plane.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and did some.
I can see a plane outline in that vehicle mm-hmm. right there. The high speed vehicle.
Yeah, it definitely has that picture. For me, the big daddy of these things has been when they take them to the rails. We mentioned it earlier, and I think this one is one that might be close to your heart, Scott, ever since our Rocket Sled on Rails podcast. The was the Rail Zeppelin?
Ah, yes. I've seen pictures of that one. That's really cool looking. The same guy that designed the Air Zeppelins, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what was his name? I got it right here. It was, you know what? Let me get through my notes here, but go ahead.
Okay.
Talk amongst yourselves, Ben.
All right.
Frank Crutchenberg.
Frank Crutchenberg.
Also responsible for designing Zeppelin airships.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
It makes me wonder what I'm doing with my life.
Had a BMW aircraft engine.
Yeah, and it was incredibly large, too. I mean, I'm assuming because it's a
Well, you know what? Maybe not so much. Let me show you something.
What's that?
Take a look at that photo right there with a human standing next to
you. Ah, to put it to scale.
Yeah.
Okay, so
it has the I don't know how the proportions of being a huge vehicle. And when you hear that it's made by the designer of Zeppelins, you think massive vehicles. But
sure.
When you look at a human next to it there, it looks like the thing is probably about 5 feet tall.
Yeah, the person standing next to it is taller standing up.
Large prop on the back, but very streamlined design. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, very fast. I mean, it went, 145 miles an hour again? On the rails in 1931. That's incredible.
That's so incredible that one of the big questions we had to ask ourselves while we're researching this is what went wrong? I mean, this access to this kind of speed and velocity is this kind of speed, if not acceleration, is just amazing, especially for public transit. And the question is, were the drawbacks and the dangers really so high that it precluded it?
That and, from what I'm reading here, World War II.
World War II.
World War II put a stop to a lot of this, and that was just simply because, you know, the designs sat on a drawing board somewhere, they were put in a file, and just filed away. I think that the danger aspect of it, the downsides far exceeded the, you know, the, just because the danger aspect of this thing, you know, the potential for something to go terribly wrong with these, that far outweighed the benefits were, of course, the high speed and, you know, possibly the efficiency of something like this. But yeah, the World War II, the onset of World War II, I should say, just pretty much killed all of this in its infancy, and then it never came back.
Yeah, because by that time, now, as most people know, the thing about large-scale war is that a lot of times it does lead to the creation of new technology. But it leads to a sort of myopic concentration because you tend to create things that will help you win a war versus things that will help you address concerns like – the concern about oil is much bigger now, right, than it was. So these were probably not as attractive. And a lot of these were still, you know, there were still gas-powered vehicles.
Sure.
So depending, you know, as you and I have said, we don't know for sure how efficient or inefficient these vehicles were. But I can't help but think, Scott, that we as people – as the human race kind of missed the boat on this because now there are high-speed trains, maglevs and whatnot. You cannot build a propeller big enough.
Well, you know, we've passed this, I guess. We've gone past the point where these may be, you know, viable form of transportation or something that, you know, we would want to see on the road. Like we said, we keep talking about danger, but looking at this car, that, you know, I said that they went away and they never came back, but they did come back briefly. I mean, there are people that still try to do things like this because, you know, the wind, you know, trying to harness wind power and things like that. But you know, the Argentinian aero car that I mentioned, I'm going to show you a photo of it, but it looks like it looks a bit like a Tucker almost in its design. It's kind of a cool looking design. And I think I kind of wish I would have been able to see one of these in person, you know, maybe even a museum or something, but I'm sure it's out there somewhere. But there was another one that came around, and there was a car at Jalopnik. You ever go to that website?
I did not check them for this stuff.
They've got, you know, interesting blog posts, you know, here and there, a lot of photos. They found a car on eBay that was it's called a Jetstream, I believe. And, again, I'm going to search through my notes and make a lot of noise here as I do this, but I got to say, it's kind of a Mad Max-looking type vehicle. And let me just make sure. It's called a Jetstream propeller car. And it was built in 1985. It's a kit car and has the prop in the back. Really strange looking vehicle. They have one that's, you know, completely made up that's painted in white, you know, from the factory and, you know, made to look really nice.
I believe
the one that was for sale on eBay at the time is the rust colored one there that's probably just gel coat or something like that. I bet it's fiberglass if I had to bet.
Man, I want one of these.
It's kind of neat looking. The thing looks like it's about 25 feet long. It's a big car. And it has kind of that 1980s futuristic look to it, you know.
Yeah, it does, but, especially with that paint job.
Yeah, Back to the Future type look to it. But that's interesting. You know, like a bubble canopy top.
Post-apocalyptic, man.
Yeah, it's really a strange-looking vehicle. Wedge shape in the front. Really weird. But
it's a one-seater.
So it comes back here and there.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's always going to be someone that's tinkering around their garage or, you know, someone that decides they're going to try to build a I don't know, like a kit car type company that would make something like this.
There's another thing, though, that people are doing. Oh, wait, this is what I wanted. Scott and I try to make surprises for each other sometimes. We pass around. But I think you already have this one.
Oh, yeah, I have. Okay. But you know what? I'm glad you brought that out because that's an interesting one, too. That's a guy right here in Georgia.
Yes. So a Georgia mechanic named B.F. Ponder. When was this?
Keep reading. I'll tell you when it was because I got a note here.
All right, Scott, you've got me on this, but this is an archived clipping from newspaper.
Yeah, that, Modern Mechanics from 1934.
Thank you, Scott. 1934. You're on the ball, man. So this prop-driven car, 1984, hit 85 miles per hour.
1934. 50 years prior.
Oh, gosh.
So this is a long time. I mean, when you look at the car, it looks like a Model A or something, or Model T.
Yeah, it does. It does. And it looks, you know what? It looks like the front half of a Model A or Model T.
It looks like a Model T because it has the wooden wheels.
That's why.
Yep.
Yeah. And so this guy took a four-bladed airplane propeller and just mounted it on the auto chassis. And so he managed. I love how they say that. Like, it was so simple.
It just mounted it on the
just
auto chassis.
Just put it on.
Yeah,
just,
that's right.
You know, snap. It's a snap-on.
Never mind that prop shaft that goes through the passenger compartment, out the back end where he tore the back end off the car.
Pay no attention.
Yeah, that was easy.
That's the man behind the curtain
right
there.
Very easy.
So people have, like, a lot of these things were driven by independent inventors.
And this thing, I mean, you look at it, it's silly looking, but it worked. And it went 85 miles per hour with nothing driving the wheels other than, you know, the propeller pushing you through the air.
Also no windshield.
Wait, I keep saying through the air. Pushing you across the ground. That's probably the way to say it, right?
Yeah, that's probably a good way to say it.
No windshield. Yeah, that's right. Good point.
And did you see also, here's one actually for anybody who wants to make their own propeller thing. If you guys are...
Oh, yeah, what a great idea.
If you guys are out there listening saying, oh, Scott and Ben are such sticks in the mud.
Really?
Why are you guys...
I would do it with no safety, too. I'd just leave it open prop, just wide open.
Yeah, why do you even need wheels,
no.
You know? No, I'm kidding. But the one thing you can do is you can put a propeller, relatively easily attach a propeller to the front of a bicycle.
What?
That's what some of the Germans have done,
yeah. Come on.
Or have done in the past. I don't mean to make it sound like every German person does it.
Also sounds extremely dangerous.
It doesn't look that safe.
Let's say you hit a curb and your arm goes, you know how you kind of like, your hand slips off the grip and it goes forward?
Yeah.
You end up like with your arm, you know, your elbow on the brace maybe, or on the hand
grip?
Yeah. What happens to your hand?
I don't know. I guess it's removed
from your body. It becomes no longer part of your body.
Yeah, but if you guys get back together, you probably both learned a really good lesson.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, so it is a relatively, I had a photo I can't find to show you, but it is a relatively simple arrangement to link the chain from the gear shaft instead of linking it up, instead of linking it to the wheel from the pedal, you link it from the pedal to the propeller.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the one. The propeller drives a novel bicycle.
Yeah.
And,
ridiculously dangerous, Ben.
It is ridiculously dangerous, but it's so easy to do it. It's so easy to make it.
I guess so. I mean, we're talking about how dangerous prop-driven cars are, and that's with a prop 5 feet in front of you or 10 feet in front. Well, 5 feet in front of you.
Yeah.
This is within arm's reach.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
You know, how many times have you, when you were a kid, how many times did you go over the handlebars onto the ground in front of you?
Oh, man.
You would have been shredded.
I like to, you know, memory gives me rose-tinted glasses, and I would like to say I spent more time behind the handlebars than in front of them, but I'm not sure.
Not me. I went over the handlebars many, many times. I would have been shredded the first time I went through.
Yeah, you're right. It is dangerous.
Very dangerous.
It is just like
having
somebody.
Well, I guess, that's if you're pedaling like, you know, super fast too, if you're trying to go 40 miles an hour or something.
But that's the thing. You almost, it's tough because you still have that same acceleration problem. Can you imagine?
maybe it just really hurt. That's
trying
all.
To push this propeller down up a hill by your pedals.
Yeah.
I've only got one more and it's really
cool. This is crazy. Okay.
All right. So. Riddle me this. How many gas stations are in Antarctica?
I'm going to go with zero.
Ding, ding, ding.
Really?
Yes.
Zero.
Well, not gas stations as we understand them. Of course, people have to keep supplies at the research center. But, my friend, have you heard about the Moon Reagan Transarctic Expedition?
Believe it or not, I have.
I would be disappointed if you
I had. Think we talked about it briefly when we were talking about the Arctic vehicles, the polar vehicles.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Do you want another ding, ding, ding?
What about this expedition?
Check it out. Wired.com has a great article on a Lotus Concept Ice Vehicle, or CIV, and I want you to Let me check this bad boy out here, because this is a three-ski design, and the front ski takes – it functions kind of like a braking mechanism. It's got some studs, and it is propeller-driven. I hope you guys saw that coming.
Mm-hmm.
And these are used as scouts for the vehicles that actually carry the scientist or research teams and their equipment.
Huh.
Now, those vehicles themselves are pretty awesome. They've got six-wheel drive, huge engines, 20-speed transmissions. But the CIV is actually so light that the driver or the crew can hop out and just drag it across the terrain if it's rough to ski.
This is a big vehicle, too. I'm reading this. It says it's 15 feet long and 15 feet wide.
Yes.
It's big.
There's some weight distribution going on there, I think.
Yeah. But it uses a BMW motorcycle engine for the prop.
Which is, you know, I got to be honest with you, for that size, that's surprising.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Boy, that's a neat looking vehicle. I like that.
You'd like to have one?
Yeah, I think I would.
All right. Well, filed away.
But that's behind you, though, too. That's pushing you.
Yeah, I would much rather have a prop behind me.
I think so, too.
Yeah, even with your fear of airboats?
Yeah, I think it's all right because it's got a solid body behind it. Looks like you're sitting in front of something solid rather than just that tiny, you know, thin meshwork that you're in an airboat.
That's the thing. Oh, man, that's the thing. How surprised were you? I'm sorry, I'm yelling. How surprised were you by just the sheer amount of vehicles with no windshield, protection of any sort between you and the propeller?
I guess, again, these are guys just building stuff in a shed in the backyard. You know, they were working with relatively crude tools, I would assume. Yeah. But you know, I was an easier time, Ben. Easier time. I mean, they'd take metal from wherever they could find it and pieces from other vehicles. And it wasn't like now where, you know, if you're going to bring a prototype out, it better look good. Otherwise, no one's going to pay attention to it.
That's true.
This was just dramatic new ideas.
It was a different time. Now, I'm going to go ahead and make the call, and I hope somebody – I would love to be wrong about this, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Correct me if you can, because I would love to be wrong about it right now on the air. But I have a sneaking suspicion that propeller-driven vehicles are not really going to be on the road or on the rails in the future. I think we are going to see them in – Arctic or snowbound conditions. For example, we could have used them this weekend.
That's right, with the ice and snowstorm we had.
Yeah, it was called a snowpocalypse. And for Star Wars fans,
very dramatic.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard this, but for Star Wars fans, people have been calling it Hothlanta.
Oh boy,
because the ice planet Hoth. And,
oh, that's terrible.
Gosh, I'm just digging my hole. Anyway, so I think we'll see them on the snow, and we'll maybe see them in the swampy areas, but those are more boats, you know, the airboats.
So like ice boats or something like that, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? That's a really good point because those environments are the only environments where the consequences of using this admittedly innovative propulsion system do not outweigh the benefits.
Okay. Got it. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, someplace where you don't need traction, or where you do need traction, it's probably difficult or if not impossible to get on, you know, sheer ice, like we were talking about. It seems like a reasonable way to get around.
No pedestrians, no stop and go traffic.
No pedestrians, nothing really to worry about.
Man, the first thing that would happen to me is I would either cut off my hand if I was on the bike, or I would accidentally get hit a pedestrian or get rear-ended or something.
See, I guess you don't have to worry about like caribou or something like that.
Yes.
Maybe a polar bear.
Which apparently caribou would be startled by the noise, so hopefully they wouldn't just hang out in the way.
Yeah, you're right. They would move.
Yeah, it's tough out there.
Good point.
On the tundra.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty much out, man.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I wish there was more about these because, you know, with so few examples existing now, it's going to be hard to even find these in a museum anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck finding them. There's only a couple of examples of the what were they, the helicraft or helicars or
yes,
whatever.
Yeah.
I forget the name they were using, but
Helica.
Yeah, there's only a couple of examples of those around still. Private collectors, I believe, own those at this point.
Yeah.
But you can still find photos of these things online and watch. You can even watch a YouTube video of that one example that we're talking about, the 1932 mm-hmm. version. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to watch. I like looking at stuff like that, you know, these oddities.
Yes.
From automotive history. It's fun.
And we hope that you guys have as much fun looking at it as we have. We'll probably still be scouting around. I really want to see more modern propeller cars. I know it's not going to happen. They're Dr. Seuss status.
We're beyond it. Yeah.
Yeah. We're past all that. So, here's your chance, you guys, to take a closer look at one of the little known, but tremendously, I think, popular, attempts to change the basic DNA of the car.
Yeah, I think it's one of the, it's one of those examples where you can look at it and say, like, well, this guy had a pretty good idea at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just why didn't it work? Why didn't it take off at the time? Take off. There you go.
Hey,
why didn't it take off the way it probably should have? And, maybe formulate your own conclusion there.
Cause sometimes ideas don't fly no matter how many propellers they have.
Oh boy.
I know. We're getting all text
up. Yeah, let's wrap
it
up.
All right, we're wrapping it up. So, guys, Scott and I are heading out of here. If you want to contact us, we'd love to hear from you. Hit us up on Facebook, on Twitter. You can also check out our blog. And if you have questions about anything automotive, go to HowStuffWorks.com or email us at
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.